Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
What if I told you there is a world where not only are monsters like vampires and werewolves real, but they have rights just like you and me? And in this world, there exists a secret government organization dedicated to keeping you safe and making sure they follow the rules. Welcome to Anarium, a Monster of the Week podcast. Each episode, you will follow the story of three agents of Anarium, played by Rob Hamilton, Taylor Catron, and Cameron Baker, as they navigate through the treacherous world that Game Master Samuel Herbert has imagined for them. Tune in on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. It's dangerous out there, folks. So, remember, leave the monster hunting to us, the professionals.
Welcome, everybody, to tonight's episode. Today's episode, if you're listening to that in the middle of the day, since we launch our episodes at 6 o'clock in the morning, I just shouldn't say tonight, I should say today. But regardless of the time of day that you are listening, we are glad that you are here. Mr. Lee Wanika Miller sitting opposite the mic from me tonight. How you doing, sir? How are things down in Connecticut?
Things are going very well, and we are glad, so glad indeed. There's actually a song about that, but I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to do the same thing at this moment. Maybe later, but not at this moment. No, things are going really good. I had a great day. I had the day off, which basically meant worked TTJ. Yep. And got a lot accomplished, moved a lot of needles in the right directions.
So if you're not paying attention, earlier this month we put out a video about our latest project, what we're calling Project Kraken, part of Kraken Week 2024. We are putting the finishing touches on an adventure path, on a three-level adventure path for that. If you're interested, go check out the YouTube video. It was a real hot time. Thank you again to Ginny D for putting that together. It was a lot of fun sitting down and talking about it and working this sucker out. Yeah, go check that out.
We will probably come back either here and probably definitely on our various vlogs that we do on YouTube as well, because we have come across some interesting things that will be neat and worthwhile to talk and share with our content creator audience and our player audience, so they have a feel for it and we can get some commentary on some things.
Yeah, I certainly see an episode in our future talking about that project when it's done, for sure. In the meantime, speaking of projects which are not quite done, but worthy of speaking about, tonight on the show, we are going to be breaking down some of the, and I say some of the, because boy, oh boy, is there a lot of it. Some of the information that has come out about the 2024 release of D&D. So we are recording this end of July right now. When the player handbook is released, we're going to know officially exactly what is in there. And in the meantime, we have, what, 7 or 8 UAs worth of material and hours of video and reviews and everything like that Wizards has put out going ahead and talking about it. We are going to try to cut through the noise a little bit here, and we're going to do 6 things on D&D 2024 release tonight. So Lee Wanika and I have a list of things that we wish to go ahead and speak about, and we're going to toss them back and forth and hit them up a little bit here. But Lee Wanika, I know you said that you wanted to go ahead and touch on something before we get into the 6 things, so have at it. It's a precursor here. Where is it we want to start?
Yeah, so as I have spent most of the last month reviewing all of these videos, or as many of them as I could get to, between the shorts and trying to figure out which ones are just pieces of the larger ones, it got a little challenging. There's a playlist. We'll include the link to the playlist in the show notes here. But as of the time of this recording, 68 separate videos on the official D&D playlist. So there's a lot of material. Now, many of them are fairly short. Some are only 57, 30 some odd seconds. Others are an hour plus, or 30 minutes, or 40 minutes. So there's a lot of material, and that's not including all the shorts that just pop up. Because when you're in the space, you get all the things, right? And that's just the official stuff. That's not even talking about other YouTubers and other podcasters and their takes on the things that they've heard, which are also valid and worthwhile to listen to, so you can get a sense of things, even though my goal personally was to watch videos before I watched anybody else's take on said video. I got to watch a video, jot down my thoughts, my notes, and then if I listen to other people's, I could see if that matched, was in opposition, so on and so forth. So this is cool. And interestingly enough, Josh and I have talked very little about this in the past month directly. So I'm going to be hearing Josh's thoughts in, for the most part, first time. So I'm very interested in that.
I agree. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting. It's going to be very interesting to go ahead and see what I thought. We compared notes ahead of time to go ahead and make sure that we weren't going to be stomping on each other. But other than the broad topics, this is going to be very interesting. I'm not sure what nonsense is going to fly out of Lee Winnicka's mouth tonight. I think with that kind of a precursor, I think it's time. Let's go ahead and see what that nonsense is going to be here.
We're going to roll some dice.
Yeah, I was just going to cede initiative to you, my friend, and let you start tonight. All of our topics are somewhat complementary. We have different topics that we have, but they're somewhat complementary. They do play off of one another, so I am happy to let you go first, and then whichever one you happen to talk about when we start, I will go ahead and feed mine from there.
Sounds good. I'm going to start, since initiative's gone my way, I'm going to start with the biggest takeaway I got from all this as far as the thing I'm most excited to see, and that is the weapons mastery rules. I absolutely love that this is going to become a true thing. Now, they're a little light on what that thing is going to be exactly like. We've seen or heard about and heard tale of three or four things, but we don't know all of them. We don't know in their entirety which weapons are going to have what. We don't know if there's going to be new weapons added, but in theory there's a framework, so as content creators like us bring up new weapons, we'll have other things that we can do with them. And as a big fan of the masterwork weapon process in 3.5 and the ability to make weapons special and unique even if they're mundane, so not everything has to be magic, because I like a lower magic world, but I still want the cool factor to scale, this is a big key. And if it plays as well as it's described, I think they did a really good job. The folks that have a lot of other powers have a much more limited availability to this, in that they have it, but they can't get as much of it. The ones that need a lot of it get a lot of it. Fighters.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the fighters' damage, the fighters' abilities and competency in a combat encounter can scale, even if it's not specifically the damage. That's something that we've been doing in some of our content creation, is when we make magic items, it's like, it's not that it needs to do more damage, because then your bad guys just have to have more hit points. It's just that you need to make it do something cool. Give it a neat ability to do something that matches the style of the weapon. I personally have taken some time. I've been watching a YouTuber who talks a lot about weapons and problems with weapons, and it is Alt Roll. Again, that's one of those links we'll put in the show notes. They're his take, and he had started months ago going through 2014 weapons, and he actually switched gears halfway through the list of each 2014 weapon, saying now that they're doing this in the 2024 rules, a lot of the things I'm talking about are actually being incorporated in a different way, because he was basically saying weapons need to be cooler than they are, because weapons in real life did cool things. And I cannot agree with that more. Weapons mastery is a ticket to that ride, and I'm here for it all day.
Yeah, I totally, thoroughly, 100% agree with you on this. I think that weapon mastery as a concept is brilliant. I think that it is just fantastic. And I really think that I like the way that they did it, where, you know, you as a character need the ability to use the weapon mastery traits that are then assigned to the weapons. I think that is a really elegant way to split the divide between, does a character do a thing or does the weapon do the thing? So then if you and I both have weapon mastery and you need my great sword with super sharp edging or whatever, you can take my great sword and do the thing. It makes found loot that you find in your dungeon a little bit more versatile, because now it's really making a difference. You've already got a weapon with a special property. I don't, blah, blah, all those sorts of things. It opens up a ton of discussions on that. I feel like like the host of Around the Horn over here, as you were talking about weapon mastery and how much we liked masterwork weapons in 3rd edition, I felt like, ding, I'm giving you bonus points over here. It was a good time. I will say that that's the one thing about all of this information that I think is going to be a recurring theme to my notes. I feel like they went back and they studied the things that worked in 3 and 3.5 and they brought them back, which I think is good. And we will see this, I think, in other places. The things that I liked most are some of the things that that really worked for me in the earlier editions of the rules. So I'm very happy that they went ahead and did that. I also think that this weapon property, I think, lends itself really neatly to interesting rule combinations. Think about if you go through the UA and you read some of the properties that were in there. Think about using Sentinel and Topple, for example, right? Yep. The ability to go ahead and make sure that the dude in front of you is hitting you and you get to go ahead and knock him down and take him prone. Hot. Think about heavy weapon master and cleave. Cleave is a old school 3.5 third edition feat. Heavy weapon master really lends itself to that. Sharpshooter and graze, the ability to go ahead and do something to a character even if you miss them. Sharpshooter you're not going to miss very often, but imagine, like, I think that there's a lot of possibility in there too. Hex and Vex, I think that's just fun to say. So I can see a warlock built on Hex and Vex properties. I think that'd be freaking brilliant. So yeah, it's just amazing. I love it. I love that they're getting back to the concept of expertly conceived weapons that are not explicitly magical. I think that is a good thing. They are condition-inflicting properties, which is always great. And I think you're right. It really opens up the door for a lot of really interesting custom weapons in the future. As a content creator, the ability to design new condition-inflicting properties and new weapons that have or that use these in interesting ways. The sky feels like it's the limit for those, and I'm very much here for it. I think that's a fantastic addition to these rules.
Yeah, my one caveat is I would hope that they lean into or look at some of the things that Pathfinder 2E and Pathfinder has done and increase the number of conditions. I think the conditions they have are good, but I think there are some others that if they're official conditions, and then you can even if they didn't create them yet, if they have an expanded list of conditions in the core rules, then we can later create weapons that have those mastery properties for those other conditions. I'm thinking of slow and a couple others that exist in Pathfinder that are not currently in the D&D 5e rules. You know, I have heard nothing to say that they did, and they may in fact have not, but that to me is fertile homebrew at my table kind of ground.
I'd be surprised if they had more conditions, honestly. Like they're adding Dazed, which is an interesting one to add. It's not, so that's an interesting one, but yeah, I don't think that they're going to go quite to the depth that Pathfinder 2 does. I don't think that they're trying to get that crunchy. They are getting crunchier with these rules. I don't think they're looking to get that crunchy.
Fair. Yeah.
All right, cool. Let's see here. Which one do I want to go to next then? I think I'm going to go ahead and take what I think was my favorite change that I read about, and that is how they are reorganizing feats and how they are implementing the rules. We've seen these alluded to in UAs leading up to now, and we've even seen them sprinkled into other rule books where you've got first level feats, fourth level feats, and then go on. I think that they could have gone a step further with it, but that's an argument that we'll have for another day. I really think that they should have put out 8th level feats also. Really complete that feat level tree, but I'm also not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. I think that feats organized by the level that the character needs them to be at is a great idea, and I like the throwback to the 3rd edition rules again, just like you were talking about with the weapon mastery. I think that it does put the onus on the players, right? Because the thing that you need to know if you're going to use feats in this way is that you have to think about what you want down the road. It's a little less severe because it's only going to be first level and fourth level for now, but if they ever do go to an eighth level on that, you got to make sure that you know that when you've got a progression that starts at early levels, if you want that eighth level feat, you got to make sure to take the right prerequisites at first level and fourth level to get there, right? I think that they have fixed the way that third edition would pigeonhole your character into a particular and inevitably bad path if you make bad decisions in early levels, but there's only so much wiggle room that you're going to be able to get on that if they're implementing this kind of a structure. And this definitely introduces a degree of character generation crunch that's going to make some people uncomfortable. Love it though. As if you don't think through where your character is going, that's where you're going to run into problems, right? Again, I think that they could have gone a little bit further. We saw some 8th level feats in some of the earlier UAs. I think it was the Giant UA or maybe the one with Cardomancy or something like that. We saw some feats that were labeled as 8th level only. I wish that they were in here, I think that there was some really great sauce that they were getting close to, but they've decided that they didn't want to do that, and so there it is. So,
yeah, I would agree. I think it's interesting because while they told us that feats are going to be leveled, origin feats, and then you get those other feats that are effectively like fourth level, and then you get the epic boons, which they might as well have just called them epic feats.
Epic boons are only 20th level, though. That's not really... Right. I'm not going to give them credit for that.
I will give them credit for that because they have also said in some of the videos that the game will allow for, not that a ton of tables do, but they will allow for play after 20th level. So there's going to be rules that tell you how many levels or what you might need to do. If you're playing Milestone, your GM just decides when it's going to happen, where you would then get the ability to select another epic boon beyond 20th levels. And I think that's cool. As I'm currently playing a 20th level character in a game that has several characters that are 17, 18, and 19, and we're not going to be doing that in that game. I actually did ask that question, but it'll be nice the next major campaign that goes to that level, I might be able to do that. Because for me as a player, as much as I love the character, because I've still got probably 6 months to a year of gameplay, I'm never getting another level. I'm never getting another feat. My character is now static. That will allow that to not be the case in the core rules of the game. I think that's pretty hot. That little amount, we don't know all the details, but that little amount we do know at this point, and I like that. I like all the things you said, so I'm not going to rehash that. But I will say, I just love the fact that feats are now part of the core rules. Remember, in 2014, even though every table I've ever been at used them, they were an optional rule. They will no longer be an optional rule, and I love it. I love the fact that every character starts with one via their background. I like the fact that humans get an extra one, and it just gives you a better ability, and that extra one is an origin feat only. So the power level is limited, but I love the fact that just like in 3 and 3.5, you could have, if you played in Faerun, if you played Forgotten Realms in 3.5, you could, wherever your character is from, if there is a feat for being from the Dale Lands, there is a feat for being from this odd place or that odd place. I had designed a bunch that were specific to Alanis, the campaign we played in back in the day. I love that your background has a feat, and they didn't even do that in 3.5 where you got that from because of your background. You had to use a slot to do that in the beforehand. So I love the iteration that we're seeing. Will every feat be great? Probably not. Will feats be nerfed a little bit so they fit the new paradigm? Probably yes. Will other feats be amped up? Probably yes. But the one thing you didn't mention, Josh, that I think is exceptionally hot is the fact that you get to the levels where you get a feat. It is an ASI plus the feat. So every feat, you get a plus one and a feat, or you take a plus two to your various stats. And that is by design in the core rules, and I'm here for it. I've always said, it's fun to get the new numbers, and you may want them for X, Y, or Z, but the reality is those feats are more useful and more narratively cool than any plus one or plus two you're ever going to add to your character. So I always felt bad about being mechanically worse to get the flavor that made the game more fun. They have addressed that issue, and I really like it.
You'd be hard pressed to go ahead and convince me that getting a feat instead of a 1 point ASI, if you got a feat that was powerful enough that didn't have a half ASI on it, I'm not buying that makes you mechanically worse, because normally those feats are more powerful than the feats that give you the half ASI, right? That's the whole point. And we have done a bunch of feat construction between us, right? And we have always scaled it in that way where it's like, if one feat is super cool, has a really great thing, and maybe like a ribbon ability to go along with it, no half ASI. But if you've got a feat that's, it's nice flavorfully, but could use a little bit of oomph, the half ASI is the way to go ahead and improve that. I'm not going to buy that only taking a feat makes you mechanically worse for not taking a half ASI.
I would agree with you, and I should amend my statement. And the mechanical worseness that I was referring to was when you go to roll a saving throw.
But you're not mechanically worse, you're just mechanically the same.
Correct.
And your proficiency bonus goes up, so inevitably your saving throw does go up.
Not necessarily as much. But
hold on here, because I'm not going to let you go. I'm not going to let you go on this. I'm going to go ahead and, because think about it too. Even if I take a half ASI feat, a 1 point bump in any of my abilities is not going to go ahead and improve my stat modifier. It normally needs a 2 point bump. So unless I'm already like halfway, that 1 point ASI is really not going to make a difference. My proficiency bonus is going to be way more effective in improving my as long as it's a saving throw that I'm proficient in. Right.
I play a lot more fighters than you, and I get enough of those where it is over the course of a character, it is a marked difference. My fighter versus other fighters, but neither here nor there. Those are choice issues. I like the way the rules are going. They make that choice easier for me now.
So. Agreed. All right, sir. What's next?
So I was tempted to go one way or the other way, but I'm definitely going to do the thing that I've done.
Seeing so you have two more ways that you can go. I'm glad you were tempted to go one way or the other one. If you were whipping out a weird third way here, I was going to call you Robert Frost and tell you no.
That was entirely a probability possibility. What I will say is that I am going to go with the one who brought me to the dance, and that is backgrounds. I really feel strongly about the concepts they're discussing. I love the fact that, again, feats come with these backgrounds. I like the fact that the background, basically your upbringing, the things you experienced in the history of your character, are what's going to inform your stat bonuses versus other areas. I think that's important, and I like the way that fits. I've heard some commentary about the fact that when you get to the character construction piece, the backgrounds come after the class. I understand from Jeremy Crawford, they think the class is the most critical function, so they wanted to put that first. I disagree with that opinion. And think you should, but I'm a fan of life path character generation. So in general, for me, I would say species, background, class, but they are doing it class, species, background. And I think that's weird. But it shouldn't be so difficult that weirdness makes it difficult. And certainly if you're using D&D Beyond, who the heck cares? So I think that's more of a Leewanika preference than a problem with the game system, but it is something I want to call out because I have heard it spoken about a few times from a few different creators in the space.
Let me take that point for just a second, and I don't want to interrupt your overall point here, but I want to give a little bit of context on that. What that problem fixes is I've rolled my stats, I've chosen my background, I'm looking at my stats, half the classes in the game aren't available to me because I've already decided what my ability scores are. It fixes that problem, because by saying, here's the class that I'm going to be, now I get to go ahead and build my ability scores in a way that is optimal for that class.
Yep.
I'm not pigeonholed into a not class or a suboptimal build in a class because I've already picked and leveled in my ability scores. It fixes that problem.
It absolutely does, and that's why I'm fairly neutral on the issue. Mm-hmm. I personally will never construct my character that way. One of the greatest characters I ever built was rolled up in the most old school way possible. Which oddly was very similar to this, but this was back when they had all kinds of restrictions as opposed to optimal. Yeah. There were restrictions. It was, tell us what class you want to be, then we're going to roll your stats. Raw.
Yes.
3d6, six times, nothing gets thrown out, roll that raw.
Yeah.
And do you get enough to be the class you wanted to be? I absolutely didn't. So I only qualified to be a rogue. And as that rogue, because I had wanted to be a ranger, I then went and got the Rogue Scout kit from 2nd Edition and built Razan Greystoke the First. He was a character who never got to be what he wanted to be because he was the most unoptimal build for that thing and one of the greatest characters I have ever played.
You get to be what he wanted to be because he was a Greystoke, but that's a separate issue altogether.
Define the stereotype.
But, father to 32, I think he was everything you wanted to be. Yeah.
No, he only had one. But at any rate, what I like about this is I'm always going to build my characters in my way, and this doesn't change that. So it's not the worst deal. It is something I noted. Again, a Leewanika, how he plays thing versus a problem with the system. I recognize that this is absolutely one of the best ways to make this game accessible for the multitude of players. So on that score, I give them high props, even though it's narratively weird to me.
Yeah. I like the background. I like the way that they are cracking that nut open and really letting you play with the guts of what a background is. That's hot to me. That is a really interesting way of up some really great narrative things. I also like the fact that they're giving you like canned backgrounds so that you can go ahead and say, you know what? I'm not sure what to do. What are some ideas? And then so I love it. I think that's built really well. I think that's a really good way. Honestly, the one thing that I don't like about backgrounds and the way that they're doing it, I think that giving them three languages as a blanket is weird. That's weird to me. And I think that, honestly, it's because when I think about the most underutilized rules in D&D and tabletop role-playing game, maybe in general, it's encumbrance, money, and languages, right?
Yep.
So it's, yeah, does it potentially make a difference? Yes, it sure does. Giving just a blanket three languages, is that kind of like a token? Like, oh, yep, we know that this is going to get underutilized. Go ahead and pick, you know, two normal languages and a weird one, have fun with it, you know, thing, but don't let them get in the way mechanically. Like, we're not going to tie it to your intelligence modifier, we're not going to tie it to your species, we're not going to tie it to anything. That's not true. You do get sometimes bonus languages for your particular species, but that's not the point. The point is that I think that as a background, just saying, yep, you speak three languages. Barbarian of the North, you speak three languages, even with your intelligence of 6. Go ahead.
And you brought that up, and I hadn't even thought about it because, honestly, it wasn't on my radar when I was going through the material.
It's a really minor quibble.
But to me, it is actually a rule. If I'm running a table, I will actually throw right out the door. That will not be the case. I will not let people. The entire planet cannot be a polyglot. That is weird, and that is narratively unsound.
I actually don't care enough about it to even worry about throwing it out, to be honest with you, because language is not a thing that really... I cannot think of a situation where language has ever really played a main character in anything that I have done, in anything other than comedic relief or storyteller fuckery, right? Like, that. Those are the only two things that languages have to do with.
Absolutely. And the difference is in the games that I run, specifically in the Land of 18 Seas, language is everything in that game. All of my kingdoms have different languages. So even there is no one, there is a universal common that most people know and understand.
Sure.
But each human community, each human kingdom has their own language. Yeah. And therefore, language matters to me. And I basically have homebrewed the old rules from the oldest versions of the game. Your intelligence score tells you how many languages you have. At character generation, that bonus equals any additional languages you have. If you get a +1 in intelligence, you get an extra language off the rip, plus whatever comes through your various character build. If you've got a skill, or if you've got a thing that gives you an additional language, you take a feat that gives you 3 languages, you obviously have those.
These can't.
But I actually use that in all of the games that I run, and I do also play, not that it's going to matter for this, but I play a lot of modern games, and in most of the modern games, they're very specific about languages mattering in the modern game. So if you're playing the spy game, which is 5e compatible, if you're playing army men, if you're playing Everyday Heroes, that language is important, and it came up in a couple of the Everyday Heroes games that I ran. The language that was being spoken in the place they were, characters didn't have it, so they had a whole bunch of people talking. They didn't. My character, who is a tech guy, he had a translator app on his phone, so he actually made the rolls to get that to bring up their language, and that allowed him to give that language and reveal what they were saying to the party. That kind of drama doesn't happen when you give everybody 3 languages.
Yeah. And maybe it's just me. I never use languages in that way. So that's just like that's just a lot of overhead that I don't that is a lot of mental space that I am not that I'm going to have to remove something else that's really important to me to go ahead and utilize and so I'm not going to do it.
Yep, fair enough. And honestly, it's a playstyle thing and the games that have political intrigue always have it. The games that are straight up dungeon crawls or one-shots usually don't.
Yep. All right, we are going to go ahead and step aside here and pay some bills, but we will be right back. I will get to go ahead and crack open next one, and I am going to build on backgrounds just a little bit.
Get your money for nothing and your
feeds for free. Come on, it was right there. It's right there. Hi.
Welcome to the middle of the show. We wanted to take a minute and thank the people who helped make this show possible, our Patreon supporters. We like to shout out our adventurer level Patreons, so extra big thanks to Tim Morris, Joe Harney, Dave Rideout, Adam Scaramella, and Marty Napier. Patreon supporters get exclusive content, free copies of all of our published and unpublished game supplements, early access to episodes, and free invitations to our monthly games. You can learn more at www.patreon.com/ttjourneys.
Speaking of published material, have you checked out the supplements we have on DM's Guild? We have two full books, The Traveler's Guide to Collaborative Worldbuilding, The Traveler's Guide to the Multiverse, and you can combine it with all of our supplements to make your next role legendary. Go to www.ttjourneys.com/DM's Guild for more information.
If you're looking for Tabletop Journeys swag or need a fantastic set of new dice, then you should check out the Tabletop Journeys Spring Store and our affiliate, FanRoll Dice. You can make your first purchase through FanRoll at 10% off, and every purchase helps support the show. You can learn more about that at www.ttjourneys.com/FanRoll. And if you want to get some awesome t-shirts, hoodies, hats, or other gear, check out www.ttjourneys.com/swag to get redirected to our spring store. These are the same vendors that we use for our add-ons when we do Kickstarters and stand by their products.
But the best way you can support the show is by joining the conversation. Did you love one of the episodes? Did you disagree with something we said? Maybe you just want us to cover your favorite game system a little more or talk about a brand new system. Check us out at linktr.ee/ttjourneys. That's our link tree. And join the conversation.
We hope you're enjoying this week's show. So here comes the second half. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to us. And if your platform lets you leave a comment or a rating, why not hit the button and show your support? Thanks again for listening. Now on with the show.
All right, welcome back to the show, everybody. We are continuing on with our six things that we think we know about D&D 2024 episode tonight, based on the mountain of material that is out there in the internet. And before I continue on with number four here, my next choice, I do want to give a quick shout out. I found this resource tremendously useful. We'll make sure that the link is down in the show notes here, but there is on homebrewery.naturalcrit.com has a compilation from all of the UAs and the SRD mashed together to try to figure out what this player handbook might look like. It's called the 1D&D Playtest Collation. It's exactly what it sounds like. So a lot of the things that I use to go ahead and research this and a lot of the mechanical stuff that I talked about, I'm pulling from this document here. We'll make sure that the link is down in the comments down below, but definitely if you're interested in what may be different, check this link out. It's going to be great. Right before the break here, Lee Winika was talking about backgrounds. I'm going to build on that a little bit and talk about what I think might be... Boy, I've got a lot of favorite changes. I'm going to be fully honest here. And I may have said that the feats were my favorite change, and this one might actually be my favorite change. I hold that until I talk about my third one here, but what I want to talk about is Heroic Advantage, the replacement largely for Inspiration that it looks like is going to be in there. And the reason why I like Heroic Advantage is that Heroic Advantage is finally the cure to the background problem that traditional 5e rules have. And backgrounds are great mechanically. However, the whole concept of personality traits, bonds, ideals, and everything was that they were supposed to be a driving force behind how the character acted in any given situation. They were 100% narrative. They had virtually nothing mechanical behind them whatsoever, and so therefore they were forgotten. The issues that because they were givens, nobody gave a crap about them. You'd pick them at character generation, and if you were like anybody, if you were like 98% of the players at out there, you would use them for the first couple of levels in your character, and then as soon as you, the player, decided that your character was going a different direction, even if it varied from the bonds and ideals and everything that you settled on, they quickly got thrown away, right? They went to the wayside and you settled into the character as you actually saw it, right? And now with Heroic Advantage, they matter so much more because the player can get mechanical inspiration for use on challenges that are related to these background traits, right? So if you are throwing a saving throw that has something to do with one of your bonds, or if you're throwing an ability score that has something to do with one of your ideals or whatever like that, you can gain, if you have that inspiration, you can use it specifically because of the bond and the flaw that you, or the bond and the trait that you have that relates to that challenge. This is straight out of games like Star Trek Adventures, right? Where values become chips that you can barter for enhanced roles. It makes them stronger. It makes your background choices makes your background choices have more import and have more weight to them. It is a great improvement, and it will make these choices that are still made at character generation really matter. I also think, and this is, we don't know if this is going to be in the rules or not, I think that it actually might be, given the way that a lot of the D&D 2024 stuff is being written, but I think that you should have the ability to buy off I think you should have the ability to buy off or change these traits as your characters progress, to go ahead and represent the way that characters change as they're moving from level to level and as they experience things around the world. Maybe that's just like a pipe dream of like, everything should morph, everything can change, or the way that I run games where it's, yeah, okay, we're 8th level now and you're not having fun playing the warlock and you want to play a cleric instead, become a cleric. Roll up a cleric, be a cleric. It's not really going to change the game that much. I would much rather you have fun at the end of the day. I think that with these here, I think locking people into these bonds and traits at level one is a mistake. I think that they should be more malleable, they should be more variable, and that as characters progress and see more things, the players can change them. Maybe when they level, maybe whatever, not every time that they have a long rest, that's too much, but maybe every time that they level, they can go ahead and change a bond or a trait or an ideal or something like that. I think that would maybe make them even better. I think that Heroic Advantage is a really nice touch on backgrounds in this rule set.
I would concur wholeheartedly. It was not a thing that I paid a great deal of attention to, but it was definitely a part of the information that I've been reviewing that I took note of and want to see more on. I actually had it in my notes as, I don't think I know enough to have a fully formed opinion about it. I want to make sure that it comes out well, and it's largely because of the thing you mentioned. If you are locked into a bond forever, it will definitively make a big difference as far as how well I like this mechanic. If they don't do that, I can guarantee you that will be one of the first four things I homebrew. It will be.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. Because for me, it's very simple. It is, there are things that you can, that you should have the ability to do more and change. And flaws, whether you call them bonds, traits, values, whatever game you're playing, whatever you're doing, as your character grows and changes, the character you were in your youth is not the character you are in your
middle ages. Oh, okay. I thought you were going the other way with that. Okay.
And, I will absolutely make sure my players have the ability to utilize this mechanic and change it. As long as that change matches the gameplay that they have done, I'm here for it. Yep. And if they really don't like that character at all, roll up a new character, we'll get you in at the same level, we'll find a way to bring you into the story, you can play somebody new and pick the things that you, that's my take on it. I'm not very good with I'm not as happy, though I have said yes, because I try to yes and as much as possible, with Johnny's playing Gorfax, the half-orc barbarian. Johnny doesn't want to play barbarian anymore, so now all of a sudden Gorfax is a studied wizard. I don't like that exchange, but if you want to play a different orc, Gorfax's brother who joined the party, while Gorfax goes back to defend the home village, here for it. Having it become that character, not here for it. That's just the way I play my table. But mechanically, effectively, it's the same thing. If you don't want to play the character you're playing, I am not going to make you play that character. We'll just have to find a way to make that work at our table for the game we're playing. We'll make that happen.
I find it real easy to go ahead and make that work because it's a fantasy game and we make the rules. So if you're a warlock today and a cleric tomorrow, it does not matter to my wife at all. That does not matter to me. Totally fine. It's a fantasy game. At the end of the day, you are not actually your character. You're still you're still you. You can play what you want.
And for me, that is where I will land if we can't come to an agreement, but I will always seek to have it make narrative sense.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's fair. I understand the narrative sense. I really do. And I get that there can be some things that can help smooth that out a little bit. But the problem is that if I'm playing Gorfax the half-orc barbarian, and then I'm playing Forfax his brother, how does Forfax know all the things that Gorfax know? Because me, Josh, as a player, knows all the things that I've learned.
Yeah.
Then that becomes a situation where I don't know that thing. I wasn't with you. That's a whole lot of mess.
Basically give them an ability like Tomax and Zaymont, and then they know all the same things. Now, I would rather make that fantasy change than poof, you're a cleric. Or poof, you're a wizard. Yeah. That's just me. And Yo-Jo.
All right. Number five, sir.
Moving from from very specific one mechanic type of things, my number five is a bit of a cheat code for me. I'm going to hit on a couple different things. The class information that really caught my eye and made me excited or completely intrigued to see what comes next. Those are two very different statements I'll explain as we go. I am excited to play a monk with these new rules that they have discussed. I don't know if the mechanics are going to work out as well as they seem to be discussing. Something I will mention in greater detail. We are watching the lead creators in a highly produced, very polished, exceptionally edited series of videos and snippets from larger recording sessions. And while they are trying to talk about the things that they very clearly love, and I truly believe they love the things that they're talking about here. I don't find Jeremy Crawford or Chris Perkins to be disingenuous. I think they truly like what they're talking about. But it is a commercial. It is a series of large commercials who's designed to get us interested, talking, and ready to buy this product come September. I think they're successful in that overall. But because of that, there are some things that I am like, am I excited to play it, or am I just really anxious / interested in seeing what it is? For monks, I'm excited. I like the way that it's going. I like the way they've changed the names of the subclasses, the way their combat works, and the way some of their abilities works. I didn't dig as deeply into the subclasses as much, but I like the name changes, and I like the feel of what they spoke about. I'll see it on the table when I get to play it or when it's played at my tables, but I'm excited for the 2024 monk. Similarly, the fighters, I am all about the stuff they've talked about for the fighters. First of all, weapon mastery. Heck yeah. The changes to backgrounds, the changes to everything, more feats for fighters, here for it all damn day. Fighters is a class I play a lot of, and I enjoy, and I feel for it. The thing that really made me excited was the changes to the Eldritch Knight, and I will point this out. The fact that they are not bound to a specific school of magic now means the Eldritch Knight now can do the things that other subclasses failed at doing. An Eldritch Knight can now be used to build a proper arcane archer. An Eldritch Knight can now be used to build a proper bladesinger.
Mm-hmm.
And I am here for it. I love the concept of bladesinger. I've played several in second edition. Yeah. I only got a chance to play one in third edition, who unfortunately died as a pyramid fell on him. But it's a whole thing. I've talked about it once or twice. I'll probably talk about it again, but it was sad. I was heartbroken.
At least he finally got the point.
Yeah, he did save the day. But I love the fact that this would be the proper way to build a Bladesinger, because while you don't have the world's greatest spell list, you can now make it do the right things. You take the right feats with all the feats you get. You take your Wizard Adept. You take all those types of feats to get some extra spells, some extra spell power in there through those means. And then you take the Eldritch Knight. Now you've got a Bladesinger who can really make some frickin' things happen. Be effective in combat. Be effective at spell casting with some of the changes to the action economy of the Eldritch Knight and the way spells work for them. And you can't get better than that. Lastly, I'm just going to mention I'm intrigued to see what comes from the Ranger. This is my spicy take for the night. I have been on record as being the greatest detractor of the 2014 Ranger.
I don't think the greatest. I think pretty much universally everyone said they sucked. That's, yeah, you're definitely up there.
Tasha's was a vast improvement, and I think this is another improvement. That's the spicy take, because as I've gone and listened to other people talk about the Rangers, everybody talks about how bad it is. I largely agree with the individual points they make, but I think they are missing how vastly improved it is over what we currently have. I do not think the Ranger is terrible. So many things improved in this game. This didn't match the level of improvement. Tasha's improved over the standard 2014. This improves over Tasha's, but everybody else has improved at a greater degree. And so they are still way behind overall, but I don't think that makes this terrible and usable. But one of the interesting things that came out of a lot of the discussions I heard is something that we even talked about at great length. We've actually recorded an episode, hasn't aired yet. It'll air later on. It actually might have aired last week. I'm not sure when we're scheduling it, but or might air in a couple weeks. But the issue is not necessarily with what the Ranger is, it's what the game isn't. The game doesn't do exploration well. Because the game doesn't do exploration, the one character class who's there for the purpose of exploration will never be satisfying. It doesn't matter what they do to it. Until the game does exploration better, the Ranger will always feel lackluster. So that's another problem altogether. And to me, that tells me that when I am playing at a table with a GM who will make exploration more important if I say this is the kind of character I want to play, then a Ranger will actually be very fun to play and will be useful and feel meaningful in that campaign. But that's because there's got to be a GM who's homebrewing to make the exploration pillar better. Yeah. And the core rules don't do that. So that's my spicy take on Rangers. I think it has improved. It does not stand up with everything else because the core rules don't improve exploration.
So I think your point on the Eldritch Knight in particular is a very interesting one, particularly when you look at like how the Eldritch Knight can be used to rebuild a proper Bladesinger class. I am curious to see if once the rules actually come out, if that holds true. Because there are several things I think that you're going to have to get over by taking a fighter-based Bladesinger as opposed to a wizard-based Bladesinger like we saw in the 2014 rules. And the big thing is going to be the spell list. The Eldritch Knights only get 4th level spells when they get to level 19. Up until then, they only have 1st, 2nd, and 3rd level spells plus cantrips, right? Yep. So I think that it's really going to depend on what spells are available to them, about whether or not they are a viable Bladesinger or not. I've got to think, you know, that's going to be the interesting bit to go ahead and see. How well do they, you know, like when we talked about the Arcane Archer, when we talked about the subclasses first time around, you know, as an Arcane Archer, you want to be able to Arcane Arch all the time, right? And with only, not very many spell slots, and only up to 3rd level spells, that does eventually open them up to things like Smite and stuff like that. So maybe if that's on their list, that would be an interesting way to really make a Bladesinger or an Arcane Archer really hold true. But I think that the proof is going to be in the pudding on that one. I really like the concept, and I really hope that you're right. I have some questions, and until we see the final rules, we're not going to know the answers, right? But I'm curious to go ahead and see how that actually does play out.
That'll play into the things that we don't know, what the spells will be and how and what changes have been made to spells. So, for example, if you've got your Frostfinger, if you've got any of your cantrip damage-causing spells, because cantrip damage-causing spells scale, And if you're an arcane archer, you should always be able to arch, because you could always use those, which scale. And that's something that I think will work very well for an arcane archer. If you're built with an Eldritch Knight, because they're going to get cantrips. Like I said, and fighters get lots of feats. Taking
a couple, magic adapt or something like that.
A couple of those magic-based feats will give you some first-level damage-causing spells as well. Mm-hmm. Yep. And many of the first-level damage-causing spells also scale. So
yeah,
while
a lot of times those feats don't let... They give you access to the spells, but you still have to use a spell slot to cast them. And so that's going to be... That's ultimately... Yep. It's not about... Yep. It's not only about spell selection.
I think you are correct, but the cool thing when you're taking the feats is you generally get, at least the way it used to work, and this is where we don't know, so you're not wrong. The proof will be in the pudding, right? But generally, when you take those feats, you get one free cast, and then the other one has to be cast as a slot. So you are literally giving yourself potentially, let's say you just take two of the magic feats, and each you take Magic Adept twice, so you just have to take it two different ways or whatever. Yep. You are potentially giving yourselves two more cantrips, two more first-level spells, and neither of those first-level spells are at a slot cost.
Yep.
That's not bad for an arcane archer, because by the time you're going to do some of the things you're doing at higher level, and the way that the new mechanics work for them to cast certain spells and eventually cast a first level spell as bonus action, or as part of their attack, that's pretty hot. That's far superior to what the arcane archer used to be able to do when you only got to throw two arrows downtown by the time you were 12th or 13th level.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I'm thinking a Bladesinger with the Abjuration cantrip, Blade Ward. Yes, please. Yeah. Basically, you attacked me. Now, as a reaction, that attack is now at disadvantage. Roll again. Big bad. You don't actually get to hit me now. I'm sorry. And that's a cantrip. I can use it every freaking turn. That's great. Arcane Archer with Chaos Bolt, which is a first level spell. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm down with that. Absolutely. Flavor that as the Chaos Bolt that I'm shooting are actually coming out of my bow. They're my arrows, blah, 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 all that stuff. Yeah, absolutely. First level spell, done. There's definitely smoke there. I'm not sure that there's fire, but there's definitely smoke.
It excites me to build a character the second I get a chance to and see how that goes. But I just don't want to build it for a one shot. I'm going to build that for a campaign. That's the thing I want to play to see how cool it could be. Maybe I'm wrong, but it is worth building to try and find it.
All right, so I'm going to dive into number 6 on our list tonight, and it's going to be based a little... It's the way that we built our... Totally independent of each other, we built each other with very complementary points. And I'm going to call point number 6, everyone calm down. That's basically what I'm going to say here. I'm talking about the paladins, because, man, there's a lot of sound and fury and gnashing of teeth and rending of garments about the paladins. Okay. I'm actually just going to... I almost never do this, but I actually wrote out like a full paragraph on my point here. So I'm just going to read this, because I think that it's particularly well done here. So here's the paragraph. You tell me what you think at the end. Paladins. Invincible tanks of deific might that can cast the doom of the heavens down on their foes and pump up their allies with their riveting speech and the sheer aura of their lawfulness. Except not anymore. And here's the hot take. It's the right decision to nerf the paladins in the 2024 rules. They were too powerful in the 2014 rules. They had gone bigger than their britches. They'd gone beyond what they were supposed to be. It's the right decision to pull them back. Paladins in the traditional 5e rule set are overpowered, not because they can smite, that's a core feature, but because they can smite all the time, every time, they can smite on reaction attacks, they can smite on additional attacks, they can smite when they want to, they can leave their friends behind, but if their friends don't smite, and if they don't smite, then they're no friends of... Look, it breaks down when you get to the end, but the point is that you are a smite machine, and that made it one of the most powerful classes in the game. And here's the point, especially if you're looking to multi-class. And I think that is the clear intent, to try to stop that from happening as much as it does now. Rich characters following a dedicated class path because the higher level features are better than a dip in Pooladin, making Smite a spell adds levels of advancement to the player. It makes them have to make real choices about when to activate certain powers and makes the characters better and more well-rounded. This is a good choice for playability and a necessary nerf to the 5e Paladin's abilities. And I will say this as somebody who is playing a 20th level character in Lord Androsius in Streams of Spiro, who definitely took Dip into Paladin specifically so that as an archer, he could tap into those smite abilities. So I know exactly of what I speak here. I did it, and this makes it more fun to play than what I chose. That's my take.
I am going to say this. Smite, smite, let it all out. These are the things we smite about. Come on.
Yeah.
I'm talking to you. Smite on. Now, I could not agree with you more. You might have thought your spicy take, given my divisive opinions about paladins that I have not ever truly gone into here on the show and may or may not ever do, would cause me to not agree with you. But you're absolutely wrong. I 100% agree with you. Yeah. And I think what's interesting is every single person I've heard talk about it has talked about it from the player perspective.
Yep.
Very few people, I would say the Dungeon Cast, and I listened to them talk about it yesterday and part of that episode today. They spoke
listened to that episode. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah. They spoke about it, and William mentioned that it was nerfed and said he's in the air about it. He thinks it's probably okay and it will probably be better for the table or something like that. I may be bastardizing his comments to a certain extent, but it was not the thing he was dying on a bridge for, and that was clear in the episode. I will go to your extreme. It is absolutely and fundamentally the right move.
Yep.
2014, there were certain character classes that were so good, you were a fool if you didn't dip into them.
Yep.
Whether and generally, if it wasn't both, it was Paladin or Warlock. You just had to do that.
Or at least Fighter. Even if you weren't going to go Paladin, at least dipping into Fighter so you get Action Surge.
And I do feel a strong piece of the corrective action done to the classes here was to make that process less necessary. Making feats core and structuring feats in a way that allows you to do things will allow you, if you want to play rogue and get more spells, then you just take a feat when your feat comes up. It's not killing you for your ACI or ASI, and you get a couple extra spells, you get a little bit more varied ability. You want to play a fighter with a little more diversity, do that. Warlocks or sorcerers who have a limited spell list, you want to beef that up a little bit in meaningful ways, even though it's only at the lower levels. That can be a difference maker in various encounters. One or two extra spells, one or two extra slots, and the free casting is critical in some cases. We saw that in our bard battle that we did. A couple of those spells, but you know, one of the spells that I used, which helped us win in the end, was definitively only available because I had the free casting. There's a reason those things work. I think as a design element, it absolutely had to be changed. Making it a spell made more sense.
And you still get a free use of it. Like you get one free use without using your spell slot. Everything else takes the spell slot.
Biggest change is the fact that you can only do it once per turn.
Yes. Yeah. And that is huge and important. Sorry, but it was overdone. It was way over the line.
If you played a fighter till 16th level, then played a paladin, or played a fighter till about 10th level or something, to the point where you get three attacks, then you take paladin for the rest of your build, you get four or five smites, and you're attacking six times. You wait for the big hit. You wait for the critical, drop the smite. Done.
Androsius is a 12th level fighter, 8th level paladin. There was a turn where he didn't even really do anything that extraordinary and dropped like 75 points of damage on a distance arrow, right? Because he gets the multiple attacks, and because of the way that everything stacked, 17 smites or whatever it was, like, it was stupid, the amount of damage that he did, basically, from afar, picking off people with his bow and arrow. Like, it was... Yep. And that character is built specifically to do that, but absolutely paladin where I looked when I wanted to go ahead and do that.
Agreed. As spicy as that is for the community, it is right at home, and it is part of the... It is part of the bolognese.
Yep.
It is what we do.
Calm down.
Simmer down.
So, all right, my friend. We're going to step aside to go ahead and record a little bit of Patreon exclusive content here. We'll be back after that. are back from our Patreon exclusive. Remember, if you want to listen to that content, the best way to go ahead and do that is to become one of our Patreons, of course. Go to www.patreon.com/ttjourneys. You can get early access to all of our episodes. You can get exclusive content like what we just recorded there. And you can also get invites to our monthly tabletop games. We are talking about ways to go ahead and change that system up a little bit. So there may be some news coming out about that sooner rather than later. But for now, man, we play an awful lot of Star Trek Adventures with our Patreons, and it's always a freaking blast. Come join the fun. www.patreon.com/ttjourneys. Levels for every pocket. My friend, let's get into closing words here. I think that even so, our bullet points here were all in the same vein. I think when we talked ahead of time, even our closing arguments here are somewhat the same too. I'll go first and then let you go ahead and throw yours after that. I think that in general, Wizards of the Coast is making the right decision by being very transparent, for the most part, about what's going to be in this book, what they're excited about, and what they're really happy to be bringing us in D&D 24, right? At the end of the day, we crap on them a lot for doing the wrong thing, because they found a way to go ahead and do the wrong thing for a really long time. And we were all skeptical when they said that the rules would still be functionally 5e and that the 5e rules would be compatible with the 2024 rules, but they're showing the proof in the pudding by putting it all out there for everyone to see with the videos, the rules releases, previews, playtests. This is the sort of openness that Wizards of the Coast needed to do, and they're doing it. It's what the community has been asking for. So I'm going to go ahead and give them a little bit of credit for doing that, right? If we're going to crap on them when they do something stupid, I think that we need to celebrate them when they do something smart. And this has been a great idea to bring people to the discussion of what these rules are going to be, what the differences between 2024 and traditional 5e are going to be, and help get creative juices flowing. Now, the other side of that coin is that they are showing their whole ass with parts of the rules that they're showing, because some of the rules are not being received well, to go ahead and put it gently.
Ranger.
Paladin, Ranger, exactly, right? No, but then things like Monk are going to be being received very well. So, you know, so we'll see. We'll kind of see like what's in the final book. But there's something to be said for showing off something when it's good and well thought out, but not pretending that you're serving chocolate cake when you're serving a mud pie. And I'm not sure where the rules fall for me on that line just yet. I want to think that it's closer to chocolate cake, but boy, there's way more dirt in this chocolate cake than I really hoped that there would be. So, you know.
As the resident member of the show and the team who does not like chocolate, yep. I hope it tastes nothing like chocolate cake. But I absolutely concur. I think there's a lot here that remains to be seen. I think we absolutely owe it to any content creator, anybody who's made a mess of things, and their legitimate attempts to step forward and do things right.
Do to I do think better.
All,
yeah.
Do I think they're altruistic as a corporation? No. Do I think fun. that means that they're not still steaming about what they tried to do and couldn't get away with? Yes. I think they are absolutely still steaming about that in corporate C-suite offices. But I will always go back to, I strongly feel the creative teams love this game,
yep,
and are legitimately trying to serve the gaming community in the best way they can within the structure they are working within. Yep. I think that they have made a lot of good strides. I truly believe when you see the smile on Chris Perkins' face, when you see the smile on Jeremy Crawford's face, and they're talking about a given rule, and they're tee-heeing with Todd Kendrick in these videos, that's legit. I don't think that's false. I don't think that's fake. I don't feel fake. I'm a skeptical person.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I am the person who often gets told, okay, tinfoil hats off, right? Yeah. Your conspiracy theory again. Yeah. Rabbit hole, dude. Rabbit hole, right? I'm that guy. No part of my radar goes off when I watch these two creatives talk about the game they are shepherding. Yeah. That fills me with excitement and positive vibes for this game. In my final thoughts, I think the videos have done a great job of describing the problems that needed to be fixed. Every one of those videos talked about not only what this game is, but it actually mentioned the problem that their changes are attempting to solve. Part of that transparency we're talking about. They described that exceptionally well. The videos did a decent job of describing the fixes in many cases. Mm-hmm. When they talked about a problem, they then described their solution, and then they gave examples of how that would work in play, and in a few cases, even talked about how it played at their test tables and in their home games. I thought that was very useful.
Yep. It's relatable. It provides relatable content, which is nice.
Absolutely. I think the videos did an okay job about getting me excited overall, and a fantastic job about getting me excited about certain specific elements.
Yep.
And not so great at being excited about others. Intrigued, but not excited about others. And there's so many
rules. Moving on.
Yeah. And then there are so many things that I just don't know about that I'm like, eh. So my overall is, I think they did an okay job with these. Yep. And even if I wasn't in this industry, even if I wasn't a content creator, even if I wasn't doing this podcast with you, and I cannot envision that world ever, I would still be interested and want to buy these books when they come out. I would still want it to be part of my process. How much of a process it will be, whether it's the game I play regularly or whether it's a game I run regularly, that happens after I buy the book and I sit down, build a bunch of characters, run some one-shots, and see if it works for me.
Yep.
But overall, if their goal was, what can we do to have Lee Winnico be willing to shell out money for these things? Mission accomplished. I'm willing to shell out that money and see what we got. And I think that's a good thing. I will leave one thing before I go, and that's one gigantic question that all of this has left me with. It is the main issue with one of the classes we spoke about, the Ranger, and that is, where's the exploration, love? Where's the exploration, love?
Yep.
Why, with all the fixes that they have done, could they not fix the exploration pillar? There are people say maybe people don't want to play the exploration pillar, and I don't know if that's a chicken or egg thing. Since the rules have gotten successively worse about exploration, people have played exploration less. So if you start by building good rules for it, guess what? More people will want to play it.
I bet you we see the exploration pillar covered in the Dungeon Master's Guide. I don't think we see it covered in the Player's Guide.
Fundamental error. You will never get a player to feel that something is important if it's not in their book.
I'm not sure how to make players feel that exploration is important when you have to go ahead and have 200 pages supporting combat, though. That's the problem, right? Is that players need the information on how to go ahead and the things that they're rolling the dice most commonly for. I don't know. You could be, I could be wrong, but I'd be willing to bet that's, you'll see it in the Dungeon Master's book.
And I think you're probably right, but my issue is if you have no rules that are player-facing that makes each individual character have a piece of that exploration pillar,
yeah,
then it doesn't matter what's in the Dungeon Master book, because they've got no interaction with it.
It's like I was talking about with the bonds and traits and things that were attached to backgrounds. They had no mechanical benefit, therefore they got ignored. All right, everybody, that is our episode for today. We'd love to go ahead and hear your thoughts on what Wizards of the Coast is doing right, wrong, and different with the D&D 2024 launch. Of course, we are on the verge of these books coming out within the next few weeks here, so certainly this is not the last word that you will hear on the 2024 edition on the channel here. We'll be talking about the books in depth as it comes out. In the meantime, though, before we get there, we have the episode we've alluded to it a couple times. We have our episode on concentration coming up next week on the show. Star Trek Preservation is continuing on. That season's going to last probably through October here based on the calendar. Excited to be continuing to go ahead and tell that story. Yeah, that's our show for this evening. Love to go ahead and hear your thoughts. Love to go ahead and hear your comments. Wherever you're checking us out, check us out on Spotify, check us out on YouTube, wherever you're checking us out, we would love to go ahead and hear from you as always.
I'm gonna just ask the audience here, if you're hearing this podcast, whenever, however you hear this podcast, please give us a comment, just two things. Tell us the number one thing that got you excited about the previews of the 2024 Player's Handbook and information, and give us the number one thing that worries you about that book. Mm-hmm. I think that is going to be a critical and important discussion to have, because that worry column, the list of things that we as a community are worried about, that's going to be where homebrewers, that's going to be where content creators fill in those gaps. We are going to be TTJ, the Dungeon Dudes, Ghostfire Games, the Dungeon Cast, all of us out there in the industry on every level, we're going to be the ones that are filling in that gap. So if you, the audience members, if you, the players, and you, the GMs who are out there consuming this content, let us in the content creator community know what worries you about these books up front. We're going to be the ones to have products waiting for you in short order to fill those gaps, so your table and your games will be legendary.
I love it. Well done, sir. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you next week when we talk concentration. Until then, have a good week.
Good night, all.